This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 48 for Wednesday, January 21st, 2009, Argentum Tela. This week we have an interview with Damon Payne, who talks about some interesting things he's been doing with the Silverlight 2 platform. Before we get to the interview, a couple program notes. Normally publish our shows on Monday. As you've noticed, every once in a while we skip a week. This week's show is coming out on Wednesday because of some hosting issues we had. We apologize if you had any problems getting to the website. We got a question via Twitter from a listener named Ryan who was listening to the show and asked Dave Bost if he was still involved with the show. Many of you have been asking, where's Dave? As you've noticed, Larry's been doing most of the interviews and doing all the intros. Dave is on temporary assignment in Redmond, Washington, working with the platform architecture team on MEBA, Multi-Enterprise Business Applications. He's promised to send us a couple interviews while he's up there. In the meantime, if you want to see what Dave's up to, follow his developer diary at daveboss.com. And now, let's listen to the interview. Hi, this is Larry Clarkin, and I'm recording a podcast on location at the Microsoft office in Pewaukee, Wisconsin. We're joined by Damon Payne. Damon, can you introduce yourself?
My name's Damon Payne.
Wow. I guess I introduced you, didn't I? Damon, a little history. You've actually been on The Thirsty Developer before.
I was on show number 7, I think, right?
You were on show number 7, but through the magic of podcasting, you were actually the first interview we ever recorded. We recorded a great conversation about Project Euler, or Euler, depending on how you want to pronounce it. I heard it wrong the first time, so I think I've said it wrong every time since then.
Yeah, there was someone I worked with at the time who spoke Polish, so he says it's Euler.
Oh, he does say it's Euler. Okay, so maybe I've been saying it right all along. But that was actually one of my favorite ones, and I've actually gone back and done some of the math problems since then. But I've been wanting to have you back on the show a couple of different times. You've always got something interesting to say. You're one of my favorite bloggers at DamonPayne.com.
Wow, thanks.
And you're also you can get very prolific at sometimes. And one of the things that I brought you in today to talk about was a series of articles that you've done on your blog recently. And we're going to talk about, Silverlight as a design surface, and we'll get into what that means in a few minutes. But you also have, and it's very relevant to what we're going to talk about today. You have a personal hobby that you're kind of an audiophile, as it were. You're into very expensive, very high end stereo equipment. So can you tell us about that?
Sure. So, I'm really into music. I've been a musician most of my life. Taking some time off from that right now. Two kids, it's hard to find the time. But going along with liking music and writing music and liking movies, at some point you're going to want some type of audio-video reproduction system at home. So over the past 15 years, I've slowly upgraded both my space and my equipment to the point where now I've got a 20 by 25 foot room in my basement with 9-foot ceilings, and because I'm a geek, I'm always doing things like acoustic tuning the room, measuring speaker response and trying to place things in the room to give it a recording studio quality so that it's perfect for audio reproduction. So when I was looking for what to use as my first example document for the design surface project, I built a home theater layout designer, but we can talk about that when you're ready.
And you also run a social network for the speaker company that you're a big fan of. Can you tell us about that real quick?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a social network. I'm a big fan of Klipsch Audio Technologies. Paul W. Klipsch way back when was one of those guys who was around at the time that RCA and James B. Lansing when what we call hi-fi was being invented. Paul W. Klipsch was one of the pioneers there. So they have a speaker called the Klipschhorn. It's a giant wooden box that sits in the corner of your room, and it's still being made today. It's an absolutely fantastic speaker and, almost unchanged after more than 60 years of constant production. So Klipsch has a really, really big active online community for people who are just fans of its speakers and audio in general. So in addition to the officially Klipsch-sanctioned websites and events, I also run KlipschCorner.com, which is kind of another technology playground for me because I write things for people to visualize their home theater and, you know, carousels and, you know, deep zoom of their new speakers and things like that. And then I also have a lot of audio gatherings, audio home theater gatherings at, you know, at my place that are not official Klipsch events. But
Movie Night at Damon's is what they're called, right?
Yeah, Movies at Damon's. I was thinking of I was going to start posting those on the blog so that local people that I haven't invited could learn about it and come up. So, yeah.
Yeah, so this is it's neat because we're going to talk about some of the techniques that you've done with Silverlight and creating this, you know, this great surface, and we'll explain what it means as we go along. You know, but it's really cool that you can marry, you know, your love for programming and technology, and I've known you for years now, Damon, and that's you're one of those guys that has a passion with it, with something else that you're tied to. I love talking about Deep Zoom because I'm a big fan of digital photography and baseball. You know, so I can take the pictures that I've taken at, you know, Brewers games and things like that and you know, put some interesting collages together. So, but enough about Damon and, you know, you being an audiophile, and we could go on with a lot of things about that, you know, how you personally killed HD DVD. Thank you. I picked the wrong technology, but, we're actually going to talk about, you know, what you've put together. And again, we'll have links in the show notes to, you know, the specific articles that you've got, but, you've created, or you've documented the process of using the Silverlight platform, you know, as an area to create a design surface. And you and I throw around the word design surface, and we talked about it before we started recording that there's probably only a couple people who associate that term with what we're talking about. I think if we showed anybody, they would go, oh, that's what you mean by design surface. But let's explain what it is first.
Right. So since we can't have visuals in a podcast here, a design surface, my most succinct definition is it is a tool whereby which we could use keyboard and mouse gestures to build up something that has a visual representation. If you think about Visual Studio, if I could go and create a C# code file and build up a Windows form, for example, using code. So I could say instantiate this label, set its text to be this, put it at this XY location, or give it these doc properties or so forth. But, you know,
all with just the code. You're saying like notepad. We could build an entire UI if we had the time. And
really that's not all that fun for a lot of reasons. You know, it takes a lot of time to compile and run code to be able to see the visual representation. And, you know, sometimes the keyboard isn't the best way. So if you think about visually designing a Windows form in Visual Studio, you have a toolbox containing components or tools that I can use. And then, you know, to the right of the toolbox there, I have the form itself, so I can visually see what the form is going to look like at runtime. And I can drag and drop things on the form. Once they're on the form, I can move them around. I can resize them. And I can select things and then also interact with a property grid to edit the various CLL properties, say, of a label. I can set its text or change its doc or text color and so forth. So a design surface or design time environment is you know, a reusable thinger to do all of that stuff, to visually edit something.
Yeah, and it's most commonly with the toolbox, you know, the properties window. At any point, you know, as you mentioned earlier when you talked about designing a WinForms from scratch, which is code, at any point, you know, you can go see the code that is being generated as you, like, drag a button and drop it on.
Right, and that's, you know, that's designer serialization, right? Like, what is the actual final document type representation of what I'm designing? So you can think of Visual Studio, but then also if you think of Visio, you know, there's a design surface and a design time environment in Visio, very similar. I have a stencil which contains things that I can drag onto the surface. I interact with things on the surface, and, you know, sometimes you can select something in Visio and edit properties of it. Or if you think, if you're into visual modeling of systems or code, if you think of a UML tool, that is a design surface and a design time environment. There are whole companies out there, and there have been for a long time, that their only product is that they sell a design surface. It's a very interesting problem to make a reusable design time environment.
Yeah, and there's some add-ons to Visual Studio from companies that are just, you know, they themselves don't create an IDE. They just plug into, you know, the IDE that's already there.
Correct.
We talked a lot about it. We can give everybody a URL so they can go see the one that you've created in your series of blog posts, and it's damonpayne.com/AGT. And what does AGT stand for?
AGT stands for Argentum Tela.
And what does that mean?
So I realized when I went to Tech Ed last year in 2008 that all of the cool kids at Microsoft kind of use Argentum as a shorthand for Silverlight. So Argentum is the Latin name of silver in the periodic table. So sticking with that, I went to the University of Notre Dame website. Has a lot of Latin resources that you can dig through. So looking for some type of word that meant, you know, design or anything like that, I found that tela means design or pattern, and it used like a spider web as the example. So I called it AGT for short, Argentum Tela. It's also at codeplex.com/AGT.
Okay, and this proves to me once again that we're absolutely out of like normal names, right? We have to go to obscure Latin terms for things.
Yeah, next
know.
It will be Greek or, you know, what's the Swahili word that they had, Tafiti, for the Silverlight-based search thing. So, yeah, we're definitely running out of cool English names.
Well, with, you know, Windows Azure, which we haven't had a show yet, you know, on the podcast about, you know, we've gone to colors now. My personal joke is that we're going to go to, you know, guttural sounds pretty soon. Like,
yeah.
No, Server 2008,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, and why Azure? Because Azure is really not an attractive color at all.
It's the color of the sky when there are no clouds. So it's a reference to clouds.
Okay, you know? Okay. See, it's cooler when you explain the backstory.
Yeah, and I got that from the Wikipedia article, not from somebody within Microsoft. But I think that you know there is a trend in software development that's twofold. It's A, that pretty much all the words are trademarked, you know, by some software company. Like, you know, if I wanted to create a demo, you know, called Acme Computing or whatever, you know, if there's a small consulting company in the backwoods of Alaska that's called Acme Computing, you know, then, you know, I could be infringing on their trademark. But also I think that we're going to cool names just because it's kind of cool. And it's, I could tell that you spent a lot of time researching that, and, you know, it's,
yeah, it's, you know, as a developer today, you have to be conscious about things like marketing, how you're marketing yourself and what you're working on. So it definitely is worth a little time investment.
So if you go out to the sample site, damonpayne.com/AGT, what you're presented with is a toolbox. It's very visual on the left-hand side, and it's got a furniture section, an audio section, and then kind of a catch-all default section for anything mm-hmm. that you don't have widgets or items for above that. And then on the right-hand side, you've got, you know, kind of a design surface that's, you know, in this case, your living room, your den, you know, wherever you want to set up your stereo equipment. And as a user, I've actually done this in front of us as we're recording here. I actually kind of modeled, you know, my basement, you know, where my TV area is. I've got a couch, got an area rug, got a chair. Then I've got some speakers up front, and then there's a center channel. So as the end user of the application, and a design surface is kind of targeted at the end user?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what you're designing, right? So the home theater thing is kind of the first, I'll use the word stencil here, and we can talk about that later, but it's the first set of toolbox items in a certain type of document that you would create. So this type of thing could be end-user targeted, whereas a few articles down the line, when I do a UML stencil, that's obviously targeted at a different kind of end-user or more of a software developer.
A, you know, business process person or, you know, right. An analyst or something like that. But this is a good example because I think a lot of us can grasp onto this, you know, in how easy it is to mock up something.
Yes.
And as I dragged and dropped the items, it was pretty easy for me to lay it out and kind of, you know, mirror what I had. It was interesting that we talked about the property box earlier in Visual Studio, that when you click on any item, you actually get a list of properties, and it's context sensitive, you know, depending on, you know, what item I click, what properties I see. And that's right. Obvious because, you know, a button has a label. A text box doesn't necessarily have a label. You know, it has a tooltip, it has a text area, you know. So it's got to be sensitive. What you actually did was, as I click on an item, you know, in the design surface, you know, the property box kind of pops up next to it.
Right. So, you know, rewinding to history a little bit here, as of in Visual Studio 2005, for example, there's obviously a Windows Forms designer built in, and Microsoft made enough aspects of that public and extensible such that you could actually just write a Windows Forms application to host that designer in your own program. So I've done a lot of work in the automotive industry, for example, and I wrote software to host that designer in a standalone Windows Forms program where you could drag and drop and have a WYSIWYG designer for window stickers for a car. So when Silverlight and WPF came out, I was, you know, very eager to dig into that, and my early research showed that that designer is not hostable outside Visual Studio. So when I set about doing this entirely from scratch on my own, I started to think about what combination of using what I learned from the Visual Studio design time environment versus how could I also improve on this. So through talking to visual designers and so forth, I've made several little changes. For example, if you grab something and you drag it, you get a tiny semi-transparent representation of what the component will look like, versus in Visual Studio, you get the cursor with a small white rectangle. Also, the property grid floats next to the thing that you select so that it kind of pops right in there, right next to the thing. You know, just little things like that where I've tried to, in small ways, improve on the experience of using the Surface.
So this is a result of, you know, thought and talking to designers, not necessarily, you know, you didn't want to do a property grid because it was tough or something. The property grid probably would have been a little easier.
Right. Actually, there's not a property grid built into Silverlight, so I did write the property grid from scratch.
Okay.
And the method of an object inspection was written from scratch as well. So part of what I try to accomplish here is, usually if you go out and you look at people's blogs and they're trying to show you how to do something complicated, they'll kind of say, wouldn't it be great if we had this? And then they'll show you the finished application and kind of explain to you how it works and let you download the code. What I did here as an experiment is just something I've started calling reality blogging, where I in the very first article, AGT Zero, from September of last year, I said, here's what we're going to try to do. I have no code written whatsoever. And kind of write the code for, you know, what's a fairly complex system, one article at a time in bite-sized blog post chunks. And
it was more like a diary than necessarily like an essay.
Right.
Because you were doing it as you went along.
Right. An essay is, you know, is like a finished product. Whereas in this, if you were to go back and follow all of the articles, and I just published the 20th article in the series, you would see places where I say, okay, here's where I realized I made a big mistake in article number 3. Here's how we went about refactoring that. You know, so it's more of a like you say, a diary. It's an honest reflection on going back and redoing designs when you realize it didn't quite suit your needs, and how painful was the refactoring process and so forth.
Yeah, and if somebody read your blog, it was very interesting to kind of follow along. And I read it in spurts. It was like there was 1 week I remember that I think you published like 5 in a week or something like that. And I think there were 2 that were in the same day, I think.
Yeah.
Did that happen?
Yes.
Yeah. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah, and then there was a month gap. That thing that you see people say about, you know, be very consistent and regular about how often you're posting, I'm not doing so great at that.
No, that's okay. You know, we're not all Jeff Atwood. So.
Right. I go like crazy when I have the time and the desire, and then sometimes there's a little drought.
So I think we've done a good job of explaining kind of what you were at. Hopefully people, you know, who aren't listening in the car or whatever have had a chance to go over and, you know, pull it up and, you know, drag a couch here, you know, drag a chair there. I want to ask you some questions about the technology itself.
Sure,
And I'm going to start very general and very high level, you know, and we'll talk about some of the pros of Silverlight. Because one of the obvious ones that comes to mind to me is that if you ship somebody a, you know, design surface that's an installer, you know, there's a hurdle that you got to cross there, right? You know, they've got to download the software, they got to set it up, you got to deal with, you know, whatever machine that they've got, whatever they got going on in that machine. You know, Silverlight's this advanced platform with this great vector-based, you know, rendering engine that really distributes itself via the browser.
Yes.
The other big advantage is that, you know, the cross-platform nature of this, right? This works on a Mac, right?
Yes. So in some of the articles, you'll see where I've written a keyboard service, for example, so that the design is very very IOC dependency injection. So there's a keyboard service that can kind of behave differently if you're on the PC or a Mac, for example. Yeah, so I actually had a far away goal of an actual business use that I was going to use this for when I started it. And one of the alluring features was that it did distribute itself inside the browser. Not only as a way of getting this in front of end users is that useful, but if you already have a web-based system of some kind, which in this case I do, the ability of Silverlight to interact with the DOM and so forth can be very useful. So you can have a web page that's presenting data to people using HTML, you know, using markup and HX and so forth. But then also maybe in the corner you have this visual tool that does a lot of stuff that I personally would not want to try to do in Ajax.
Yeah. And the drag and drop nature of this, you know, is an obvious thing, right? You can do drag and drop in Ajax,
yeah.
But you know, even with today's Ajax frameworks, it's not pretty.
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned vector graphics and so forth. Another big advantage over Windows forms of this is, you know, your options if you want to scale, for example, in Windows forms is you can do DPI-based scaling or font-based scaling. So your application will resize if the font changes. Well, that's not nearly as pretty to code or to look at as just applying a render transform like you can in Silverlight. The other thing which I blog about constantly, I just can't say enough good stuff about, honestly, is the nature of data binding in Silverlight and the dependency property system. I want to break into song. It's so awesome.
Yeah, and that's one of the other things I was going to ask is that there's a lot of data binding going on here. I you know.
Right, and the property grid, if you look at the current state of the code, I mean, it's a property grid from scratch that supports custom editors and custom visualizers and so forth, and it's probably 150 lines of code where I would wager the one that's in WinForms is probably, you know, on the order of more of 1,000 or thousands of lines of code. Just because this is in Silverlight, I can make all sorts of assumptions about bindable objects and things and dependency properties.
Now, I will ask you something that I think a lot of people, you know, when I talk to them about Silverlight, that they, you know, a lot of people haven't quite made the jump is that how much you can do in XAML. So you mentioned that, you know, one of the nice features that you got is as I grab a chair and drop it, I've got this nice transparency.
Yeah.
How much of that is XAML versus how much of that's code?
So most of it is in code just because, you know, let me back up a little bit here. Everything that you see over in the toolbox there is a control that is drawn entirely in XAML using paths and so forth. But when it comes to, like you said, dragging something over, that's done in code just because it's dynamic at runtime. So the thing on the left there is ultimately an iToolbox service in the code. And when you start dragging, the AGT runtime queries the toolbox to say what's selected, and then it creates a copy of that, applies a render transform to it, and kind of it becomes your mouse cursor so that you can see it move around. But in terms of data binding, like in the property grid and so forth, that's all done via XAML.
Cool. All right, so we've sung the praises of data binding. We talked about the cross-platform nature of it, the easy to distribute. So, like, what was hard about this compared to what you've done before with design services, you know, say in WinForms? What about Silverlight? You know, this is the, you know, the critical.
Okay, so this is not something that most people will ever care about. But if you're doing something like building a design surface, in Windows forms, it's actually fairly easy to understand what's going on in the event loop and how and when things are drawn. So if I wanted to make some kind of custom label in Windows forms, you override the onPaint event of control, for example. You get a graphics context, and maybe you get some type of rectangle that says, here's kind of the space that you've been given within which we want you to draw yourself. And it's very, very easy then to just go to XY coordinates and draw lines. So it's very, makes a lot of sense to you from a 2D graphics perspective. In Silverlight, you have the rendering and layout is much more complicated. So there are a lot of things, like, for example, a button. The reason there's a button on this, a button has nothing to do with the home theater, right? It's just a XAML button. But I threw that in there to show in the article some of the problems that you might run across. One of them being, a button size is auto by default. What does that mean? When you go into code and you want to scale things to be a certain dimension or lay them out in a certain way, then you can run into all kinds of problems if you're still thinking about this in sort of a WinForms mode. So learning the Silverlight, measuring and layout stuff was a big problem for me.
Okay. And that's probably just an experience thing. If you come from a vector-based graphics background, maybe it would be less of an issue, or?
Potentially. I'm not really sure. Silverlight and WPF are really my first vector graphics experience since, I did some OpenGL in the 90s, but that was a whole other world.
Back in the day.
Back in the day, yes.
So any other things? I mean, did you notice that, there were libraries missing that you were used to when you were working with the full framework, or?
Well, since I was building the design time environment from scratch, there wasn't a whole ton that I really, really missed. I will say, in terms of low-level CLR stuff, there's a bunch of stuff built around type descriptors in the full framework, and type descriptor is entirely missing in Silverlight. I was pleased to find that reflection emit is entirely present in Silverlight, obviously probably needed by the dynamic language runtime. But really there wasn't a whole lot missing that I really felt that I needed for this.
Yeah, I've actually found that too. If you look at the, just the number of megabytes comparing the two platforms, you're like, oh, there's got to be things that, are missing, obvious libraries that I'm going to need. If you throw out the fact that, the full framework has like a web, full web application built into it. Well, I don't need to run ASP.NET inside Silverlight. So that's a big chunk of it that's just gone.
Sure, but even if you look at like the client-only subset of the framework that they offer now, I think that's still 28 megabytes, and Silverlight is, 4.5 megabytes? So it's interesting to listen to people on the Silverlight team or even like the Compact Framework team talk about how they get that down so small. And you'll see things like, lots of method overloads that are just convenient are thrown out, so you have fewer methods and classes. Some classes are missing. You'll notice that you can only consume services asynchronously. The synchronous methods are missing. So there's all sorts of weird tricks, and they somehow get it down to be very, very small indeed.
Yeah, and I don't find that, as I'm writing a standard line of business type application, which is kind of what I do, right? Not the heavy graphics guy. If I'm writing just a standard entry form, looking up something in a database where I'm hitting a service in the back end, I find that I don't miss a lot of that stuff. I'm sure there's going to be a day where IntelliSense fails me. I go, wait, where's that?
It's interesting that you say that, because that's actually, in my experience, where I have found more missing. So doing graphics like this, everything is there that I want, really. But writing line of business applications, I found I'm missing the built-in validation framework and things like that. So some of my other posts, I've written a validation framework for Silverlight.
So Damon, I'm an evangelist. I don't actually ship any of the code that I write. I don't need to validate anything.
There are some things that are present in WPF that I miss. The whole commanding infrastructure. As nice as the binding is, the binding in WPF has a lot of stuff that Silverlight doesn't.
Oh, it's way cool, isn't it?
The binding in WPF is the binding you always wanted and were afraid to ask for. It can really do some amazing things, but. Yeah, just things like validation and such like that I find missing in Silverlight. But myself and other people, there's several There's several alternatives out there. If you really want a commanding framework, it's out there. If you really need validation, you can find stuff.
So where do you go with AGT from here? I mean, you're 20 articles into it. I think that you've tackled a lot of the, you know, the things to get it up and running, and you know, dealt with a lot of the issues.
Yeah. So the last article I published was the design for undo support. So you can select five things, move them, and hit Control Z to undo. So the next article will be implementing that. From there, I will go to document serialization so that you can actually, you know, build, in this case, the home theater room, build that, serialize that out into some XAML or XML format or something, and reload it into the designer.
Basically then, the save and retrieve type functionality.
Right.
Yeah.
And then from there, the next thing will be actually building some additional stencils, so showing the extensibility mechanism by having by being able to define an assembly that implements has a class that implements an iStencil interface, for example. And based on that, being able to automatically load in, okay, these are the things that should be in the toolbox, these are the behaviors that the design surface should have, and this is the document type that this is going to serialize, and so forth.
So right now it's kind of hardwired to, you know, what you've got visible, and that step will be taking it to the next step and saying I can go add, you know, say I'm a furniture manufacturer, because you don't have an ottoman, you know, in here, and
I should have one. Right. So right now I'm manually adding things to the toolbox. So what the extensibility mechanism will do is to be able to kind of package this all up as an assembly, or maybe even behind a service, and get your toolbox items and your surface behaviors there. Surface behaviors is also one of the coming articles. So in Visual Studio 2008, you can drag labels around, and you'll notice snap lines when you're about to be aligned vertically or horizontally
right.
with something. So I have a mechanism in mind, and none of this is written yet. That's part of my reality blogging thing. I'm not writing any code until I'm actually ready to show it. But being able to put behaviors on the design surface and making that extensible as well. So you could say, yeah, here's some kind of iBehavior interface, and I could throw that in there and be able to create snap lines as I move things around. Or perhaps maybe I want to measure something so that when I select a couch, it says this couch is 6 feet wide by 4 feet, and show some little adorner around the couch to show you how big it is. Or maybe I want to see how far I am from the wall. So providing an extensible interface for behaviors on the surface,
and maybe even behaviors of the actual items itself, because some things you should be able to put on top of each other. Like you can put a couch on top of an area rug, but you can't put a chair on top of a couch without it being quite ridiculous.
Sure. Yeah. So that's the type of thing. I mean, I want to make it as extensible as possible, so that if someone were to grab this and to try to make something like that, they're not frustrated by it.
Right. Yeah, I'm already turning on things like if you really wanted to take this to the next step, you know, because you're going to have to factor in power as something eventually, and there are certain components that are going to have to be within X number of feet of power.
Right.
And that might be something that you would not necessarily prohibit somebody from putting something there, but make them aware of the fact that, you know, hey, buddy, you're going to need an extension cord, right?
Right.
So.
Right. So I view that as ultimately being, you know, this is a hosting type environment, you know, and stencil authors will write what are basically serviced components where you can depend on this environment to give you certain features. And beyond that, it's really up to you to decide what you want to do with it. And hopefully it's easy to understand. One thing I've done here, and this is just sort of kind of part of my worldview, but we're talking about Windows Forms and Visual Studio and so forth earlier. If you want to have a certain property that is editable in a property grid, and these are the six default values that I could pick from a combo box or so forth. In Visual Studio, your sort of contract with the designer is always is attributes, right? So I've had up to, you know, 20 attributes on a property of a class just to tell the designer how I want this to behave.
Right.
So what I've tried to do here is I made the decision early on, and hopefully I don't regret it, to go away from that and to actually make it just interface-based, so that it's very discoverable what you have to do to plug into this. You're not going around looking for what attributes to put on a class or so forth. So the contract is much more explicit.
And so are these attributes, you know, basically just markers? Right.
Know, like,
so,
you know, the designer would look to see, hey, do you support this interface? If not, I don't do that. If I do do that, if you do support that interface, then I have to do extra things for you.
Right.
Well, that's kind of cool. There was actually, you know, early on, going back to framework 1.0 time frame, there was a number of things, particularly in the ASP.NET, that were implemented if you had an interface. And if you looked at the interface definition, you're like, this is stupid because it doesn't do anything. Like, inaming container was the one I'm thinking of.
Right, or I require session state.
You yeah.
know, there's no contract there. It was just used as a marker, and really metadata via attributes would have been a better way to do that.
Right.
But what I'm doing here is making it so that, you know, you implement like an iDesignable interface, and then it's very clear to you what you need to do, what your contract with the design time environment is, as opposed to going and saying, okay, I got to put browsable on this, and then I got to put an editable attribute, then I need to go define a type converter and put a type converter attribute on this. It's much, much more clear to me what you need to do.
It's been interesting watching this side of software development, you know, over the last, you know, 10 years that, you know, we tend to, you know, go back and forth between, you know, inheritance. You know, there are guys that try to do everything with, here's my base class, implement it, override with you, you know, when you need to. There's the interface-based approach, which you just talked about. And then there's more the aspect-oriented programming where we're going to do things with attributes.
Right.
I think it's neat that, we haven't yet said that there's only one answer, because there are things more appropriately done with attributes. There are things more appropriately done with interfaces. And of course there's things that are more appropriately done with.
Yeah. I mean, that's just my personal opinion, right? I like attributes. If I was doing an aspect type thing, I would say attributes are great for that. In terms of forming a contract with something that is like a component container for you, I'd say it was less appropriate. You know, you mentioned inheritance. You know, if I'm writing a framework, I'm always very loath to make someone inherit from a base class, because they might have some other existing system that where they've already been forced to inherit.
Because you can only inherit from one thing at
right.
a time.
So yeah. Right now, you know, flavor of the month, I'm big on interfaces. And
well, that's cool. Well, I hope that everybody, you know, listening got a lot out of today's show, that they, you know, if you're interested. I don't think that we're anywhere near, you know, seeing the last article, you know, on AGT. So maybe people follow along on that. But
I think I figured it out. I think I'll be around 35 articles 35? when I say, okay, here's a 1.0 release.
Yeah, I just did a series of articles, you know, not my architecture by baseball thing, and I got to 10, and I think I'm done. You know, I had two more ideas, but I think, no, you know, 10's a nice round number. You know, I got to that Roman numeral X.
Well, I've got people following this on CodePlex now and asking me about enhancements and things. So now I kind of feel obligated. I've got to at least get this into a 1.0 release.
Yeah. Well, cool. Thanks for being on The Thirsty Developer again, Damon.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com. This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 48 for Wednesday. Blah.